May it please the court. My name is Michelle Shirk. I represent the defendant and appellant Donald Zawada. This is a case centered entirely around online conduct. Defendant raises two primary issues on appeal. First, insufficiency of the evidence, and second, the court's abuse of discretion in wrongfully admitting prejudicial evidence. With respect to the insufficiency of the evidence, the government simply failed to link Donald Zawada to either count one of attempted enticement of a minor or count two, transfer of materials to an individual under 16, beyond a reasonable doubt. This case is fundamentally different from cases like, for example, this court's 2007 case, U.S. versus Cote, in which a defendant had 30 chat conversations with a law enforcement agent, sent her a picture of himself, and showed up at a McDonald's to meet for her.
But what I thought you were going to argue, given the supplemental authority, coming back around to our first case, was that this case was fundamentally the same as Gladish.
Well, so. And that is also true, Your Honors. Our position in our original brief was that even assuming the non-existence of Gladish, the government simply failed to link Mr. Zawada to the crimes that were charged. But as I submitted, the supplemental authority of Gladish adds to the argument of insufficiency of the evidence in that even if he had been linked to these conducts, Gladish provides that this would not be sufficient to prove a substantial step in an attempt to violate 2422B. So with respect to the original argument, which we place forward in our brief,
Let's stick with Gladish. Are you now relying on Gladish?
Yes, we're relying on Gladish, which is still the same essential argument that has been put forth at trial.
No, it's not. It's not as I understand Gladish. And indeed, I think we need to, as in the first case, we have supplemental memos on Gladish. One is how Gladish applies to this case, but the second question we're going to need addressed is whether the benefit of Gladish has been forfeited. There does not seem to be any argument based on the substantial step requirement to be made in your appellate brief, and whether one was made at trial is something that we need to know.
Yes, Your Honor, and I certainly appreciate the court's position that such an argument was not made in so many words either in trial or in the original briefs. I don't believe that there's been a forfeiture here. I believe that insufficiency of the evidence has always been argued. The government had the burden at trial on all elements of the crime with respect to the attempt to violate 2422B. We've always argued insufficiency of the evidence. There was a jury instruction presented at trial requiring the jury to find.
I don't think, counsel, you should assume that just mouthing the words sufficiency of the evidence preserves every possible legal argument. If there was no argument made in the district court or here based on the need for a substantial step, based on the need for something beyond simple, cheap talk, then that argument hasn't been preserved. Now, maybe there are exceptions to the preservation requirement, but it is not enough to make an argument in the district court or here just to use the phrase insufficient evidence. It has to be elaborated. Why is the evidence insufficient? In what respect is it insufficient? And so on.
There was a jury instruction given at trial requiring the jury to find that a substantial step occurred to support the conviction of the crime. There was absolutely no evidence presented at trial towards substantial step. So, since no substantial step occurred and the jury was required to find such, an element of the crime is negated, and under the standard that no reasonable juror could have found all the elements of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, I believe that
well,
that's...
You made a Rule 29 motion, I assume. Actually, Mr. Zawada made his own Rule 29 motion. Was the lack of a substantial step part of that Rule 29 motion?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
And this is why we submitted substantial authority, and we're certainly glad to add some additional briefing on this issue. At this time, I'd like to turn to the second prong of Mr. Zawada's appellate argument, which is that wrongfully admitted prejudicial evidence resulted in an abuse of discretion. Specifically, with respect to Exhibits 1, 4, 6, 9, 10, and 12, these are an interesting issue in that they're written conversations which were presented at trial in a verbal manner. Exhibit 1 was read aloud in a two-part dialogue between Officers Mitch Kazier and Jody Edmondson, and the rest were summarized by Officer Kazier. These documents were admitted in this manner after repeated objection and much debate between the attorneys. With respect to the method of publication of these exhibits, Mr. Zawada would argue that the court...
Did the defense offer to concede that these materials were obscene?
I don't believe so.
I could imagine an argument under Old Chief that if the defense was willing to make the concession that the links pointed to obscene materials, that the jury didn't necessarily need to see the particular obscenity. But without that concession, and that concession was absolutely critical in Old Chief,
Okay. Oh, so
I don't know how one keeps out of evidence the element of the offense. And these materials, the fact that they were obscene, was an element of the offense.
So we're now talking about Exhibits 8 and 11 as opposed to Exhibit 1.
So you have two different complaints, as I understand it.
Yes.
One of them is the conversations that he had,
yes,
which were done in transcript form, and the other is the attempting to transfer obscene material,
right,
which is the other offense, and that's where you're telling Judge Easterbrook you did not concede that these were, in fact, obscene materials?
I don't know. I'm not sure
or
whether that was ever conceded.
Yeah.
I actually believe that the argument with respect to the method of presentation of Exhibit 1 is the more compelling of the arguments because it completely misrepresented the nature of the exhibits to have what was really text typed by South Bend Kelsey 13, which means really text typed by an adult male, Officer Mitch Kazier, read aloud with a woman playing the role of South Bend Kelsey 13 and a man playing the role of Planner Dude 97, which completely misrepresented the nature of the evidence. It resulted in a presentation much more likely to offend a juror and much more likely to unduly prejudice the defendant.
Why isn't that something, though, within... I see what you're saying in that this thing starts out as text, it's IMs, mm-hmm. it's on computer screens, it's never actually verbalized. But on the other hand, juries can get bored. I mean, why isn't it within the trial court's discretion to decide whether a verbal presentation versus a written presentation is appropriate?
Your Honor, the trial court actually expressed some concern about this manner of presentation and, in fact, said on Volume 2 of the transcript, page 17, if you're bound and determined to do it, you may have to defend this record sometime. Don't forget that. If you want the rope, I'll give it to you to hang yourself over his objection. So the trial court certainly noted a concern. In the end, the evidence was admitted, but we believe that it's so unduly prejudicial to misrepresent the nature of the evidence, pretend it's a woman making these nonverbal statements that were actually made by a man, that it's practically guaranteed to result in an unfair trial to the defendant.
Further, people do read excerpts of written evidence all the time. There'll be a document, there'll be a contract, and somebody will read the relevant paragraph.
Right, and this is certainly a new area in that we're dealing with Internet things. I think that it's fundamentally different for a couple reasons. First of all, because you had someone actually verbalizing things like winks and smiley faces, which are images that come into an instant message conversation. And second, the government was unable to present any authority either at trial or in its briefs to support that method of presentation. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, please.
Ms. Lowry.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leslie Miller Lowry again, on behalf of the United States. With regard to the sufficiency argument, the government submits that there was sufficient evidence presented at trial to tie Donald Zawada to the offenses that were charged against him. Although, given the nature of the type of offense, you're not generally going to have someone sitting there watching the individual making each keystroke. So by necessity, most of these cases are going to be circumstantial in nature. With regard to that, the government presented evidence at trial that the IP address of the emails, PlannerDude97@Yahoo.com, sent by PlannerDude97@Yahoo.com, were registered to SBC Global as the Internet service provider. From SBC Global, the IP address that was a dynamic IP address that was assigned to those emails sent June the 8th was assigned to the residence at 2803 Flicker Lane in Rolling Meadows. When Mr. Zawada was apprehended after arriving back at that very residence, in his possession was a laptop computer. A laptop computer that Mr. Zawada said belonged...
Counsel, let's assume the evidence in this case shows that Zawada was talking and emailing and instant messaging a blue streak. Where is the substantial step, as Gladish defines that component of an attempt prosecution?
The substantial step in Zawada was the fact that Zawada and the what he thought to be underage female actually had made plans to meet in the chats they had. They talked about a date and time to meet. Would your mother be around? And it was more than just merely a nebulous or amorphous discussion about, oh, it would be so nice to talk to you, or it would be so nice to meet you. There were some more concrete plans about when to meet, a date and time to meet, which, as stated in Gladish, since travel is not sine qua non for finding a substantial step, there are other things that can constitute a substantial step, as in making arrangements for meeting the girl, agreeing on a time and place for the meeting. So as that is what the government submits for Mr. Zawada's case, as the court interprets the statute in Gladish, constitutes a substantial step. He did not merely just talk to her in some way that, I mean, a lot of these, they'll say, I'd like to meet you, oh, it would be nice, and it may not go any farther than that with regard to that part of the conversation. Mr. Zawada went farther than that and actually had a conversation, went so far as to ask South Bend Kelsey 13 whether he should bring any type of birth control, or should I just plan on it? He was making plans about not only when to meet, where to meet, but what should I bring when I do meet. I think that holding to this court's interpretation and holding in Gladish, the actions of Mr. Zawada in trying to arrange a meeting and a time to meet, which is specifically located in the August 17, 2006 online conversations, constitute a substantial step towards the commission of the underlying offense. If we assume the evidence is what the evidence was, the government submits that breadcrumb trail leads straight to Mr. Zawada, although no one certainly saw him hit the keystrokes and actually type these messages. The desktop computer, just to reiterate, had a DSL line and a router, and Mr. Zawada had a wireless internet card, and the only evidence was on Mr. Zawada's computer. The screen names, an excerpt of the chat logs, as well as the Yahoo instant messenger profile of South Bend Kelsey.
He was relatively sophisticated with computers?
Yes. He was relatively sophisticated with computers and had gone to the extent of installing History Kill on the computer as a way of trying to erase the tracks that he had made. But forensically, we were able to not only find the receipt for History Kill, but the fact that the history had been killed the day he was arrested, immediately prior to his arrest. So the government submits that there exists in the record and presented at trial sufficient evidence on every element of the offense in this case. The government further submits that under this court's holding in Gladish, the August 17, 2006 chat logs detailing the date and time of a meeting constitute a substantial step for purposes of the statute. If there are no further questions, that's all the comments that the government has. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Shirk, anything further?
Just a couple of final points. I believe your honors have appropriately zeroed in on Gladish as dispositive of defendant's 2422B conviction. Without belaboring the point, since we will be submitting additional briefing, the government's attempt to distinguish Gladish from the present case is ineffective. In Gladish, the defendant also made specific statements about the things he would like to do to Abigail, the underage person. He described in gory detail these acts. He suggested that they meet in a couple of weeks, and he further indicated his sexual desire by sending a video of himself masturbating, which is completely another step beyond what we have in this case. Finally, just to address the original argument about the sufficiency of the evidence, and without going through everything that's already been briefed, I'd just like to point out one final time that despite the lack of concrete evidence linking Mr. Zawada to the crimes charged against him, Commander Kasier admitted at trial that he made no specific investigation into whether Mr. Zawada's computer had been spoofed or infiltrated by another Internet user. So if you have nothing further, then...
Thank you. The court would appreciate receiving memos from both parties within 14 days addressing, first, how Gladish applies to the facts in this case, and second, whether any argument based on Gladish has been forfeited in this case. And Ms. Shirk, the court appreciates your willingness to accept the appointment. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.